or well, we'll see some dualities perhaps tomorrow at the very end of the lecture. But there is one situation, for example, where there is a string theory which has particle-like D brains, D zero brains, which are stable. And if you make the coupling very large, they become lighter and lighter, and actually organize themselves in Takluza-like modes for one more direction of space-time. So in that case, in the field theory limit, they would definitely contribute to this field theory in this. They become part of the graviton in this higher dimensional space-time. Okay. So I'd like to introduce superstring theory. And I would like to introduce it as just a fermionic string theory, meaning suppose we want to build a string theory which has fermions. Okay, this bosonic string we built only had bosons, right, in the spectrum. What do we need to do if we want to have some fermions? In order to understand that, it's useful to think about how to introduce fermions in quantum field theory in a word line formalism. So remember, in the word line formalism, for a scalar field, we took our propagators and we wrote them in a Schwinger time form. I guess that for scalars it was useful to have a mass. That doesn't matter. Implicitly from our calculations of string theory, we also learned ways to produce other fields of integral spin, right? So we did produce photons, gravitons, and so on. And the way they were produced is by essentially having some extra degrees of freedom on this word line. Well, the word line was actually word sheet, so there was a huge amount of degrees of freedom, which are all these harmonic oscillators. But even just having one harmonic oscillator would have been enough to produce a photon. And at least a spin one field. So perhaps to introduce fermions, we should just try to introduce some other degrees of freedom on our word line. Now, let's be concrete. Let's look at the propagator. The propagator for, say, a massless fermion looks like this. Of course, we can bring the denominator up. But perhaps we can try to bring the numerator also into an exponent. One way to do so would be to do something like this. Add some fermionic variable, some sort of fermionic version of the proper time. So you could try to start inserting these expressions inside of Feynman diagrams. Now, these, you know, was essentially sort of a propagation for some time L with some Hamiltonian P squared, right? After we Fourier transform here, we got some propagators that was something of this form. And this was very literally, you know, the propagator of quantum mechanics, meaning that you could have thought of it as something like this. You know, the propagator for the overlap, right, for a particle for between a state that at time zero is at x and in time L is at xa with Hamiltonian P is squared plus m squared. Well, I could also have written it like that to make it more explicit. You know, put explicitly the propagation by time. Euclidean time. Just so in a Schrödinger, sorry, in a Heisenberg formalism, I would have written something like that. In a Schrödinger formalism, I would have written perhaps something like that. Well, I'm not sure that's a statement that is very good. Anyway, this formula makes sense, and you know, I would assume you know them pretty well. What could I do here? So now I have both p squared and this sort of p mu gamma mu. Let me call them h and q. Notice that q squared is p nu, gamma mu, gamma nu. Because this is symmetric, I can take the anticommutator here, which gives me delta eta mu nu. So I get p squared, I get the Hamiltonian. So these two objects, h and q, have some nice property. Q squared is equal to h. Now, if I want to work in a quantum mechanical sort of setting, I would, you know, introduce operators p and q, p and x, commuting like this. And you could also introduce some operators, some Grassmann-Ode operators, some Majorana variables in condensed matter parlance. And these operators would essentially be the same as gamma matrices. You know, they would satisfy the same anticommutational relations as gamma matrices. They would act on the Hilbert space as gamma matrices. When you quantize them, they would just give you gamma matrices. So I could perhaps write this as the right Hamiltonian now as an operator in this supercharge. It's an operator too. Okay. So now this expression after a Fourier transform is going to become something like the propagation from some xa and some position xa and some state for the fermion some representation of the representation of the gamma matrices. Anyway, let's forget about it. E to the minus LH minus lambda Q. Okay? So I can sort of think about it as a propagator in some funny space. Where now I have a standard time direction and an extra fermionic super time. So I could just equate this as by definition as something like this.
Mm-hmm. So here lambda is fermion.
Yes, lambda is a fermionic quantity. So now once it's written like this, we can try to write it as a path integral. Now, In the same way as when you write about integral, you use a Lagrangian, which has some fields which are time dependent. Now, I would probably want to assemble some fields which depend on both time and supertime. I could say that there is some x mu of tau and theta, which is defined as e to the, I don't know, I would never get the correct signs, but let's forget about that. And same for psi. So of course, we know that P is just the tau x. Just because when I take down tau, when you take a tau derivative, I get the commutator of H with x, which equals P.
Mm-hmm. So we have just another fermion in time, but what exactly do you mean by supertime?
Just this extra fermionic direction.
Okay.
It's like usual quantum mechanics is a quantum field theory that lives on one-dimensional space-time. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at a fancy space-time which has one time direction and one fermionic super-time direction. At the moment, it's mostly a gimmick. You know, I'm just rewriting the fermionic quantum field theory in a very complicated way. But it's nice that somehow what emerged right away was the very first toy model of supersymmetry. A supersymmetric system is a system where you have some extra fermionic symmetries which anti-commute to translations. Now, Q is a symmetry, it's made out of conserved charges, P and gamma, which commutes with H, and it squares to time translation. So this is the very simplest supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And somehow it came out for free in trying to define, to just study a fermion in a word line formalism. So now you might want to have a similar statement here where you take a derivative with respect of theta. Because when you take the derivative with respect of theta, you would pull down a q that commutes with h with x, and it would give you psi. Now, this is not quite correct because q does not anti-commute it itself. Q squared is h. It turns out that you can correct this a little bit, define a super derivative. And then it would be true that psi is the theta x. So we have captured everything inside this field x. You can, in principle, expand this out. It's not terribly hard. You get things like x mu plus theta of tau plus theta psi of tau plus I think that's more or less it. Yes. While if you expand this out, you get something like psi minus theta the tau x, which is what you would have found expanding this exponential. This derivative, this time derivative, this super derivative has a nice property that the theta square is the tau. So it sort of has properties which are parallel to the one of the corresponding operator. I should put a plus here. If you act with H on some field, on any field, you get the T, the tau of that field. When you act with Q on the field, you get something which is slightly different from that. So there is this that is sort of the operation of supertranslation, translation along the Q direction. And then there is the other operator, which is an operator that is useful for building new fields. The important point is that this guy commutes with this guy. So that's why it's useful. So if you have something that satisfies this property, the theta derivative of this operator will also satisfy this. So that's why it's a useful thing, and that's why it's what appears when you try to relate these fields with each other. Okay. So now you have a Lagrangian. You can write down a Lagrangian. You can even write it in superspace. And it looks like this. If you expand it out a little bit, you get something like x dot squared plus x dot psi. Plus psi dot psi. And this is precisely what gives rise to this quantum mechanics of XMP. And this is precisely what gives rise to the sort of quantum mechanics of the psis. So this sort of is the Lagrangian which would give you these Green's functions. And you would use this Lagrangian, so the Green's function will be the propagator for this Lagrangian from time and super time zero to time super time L and lambda. And then you can even try to do things to continue the analogy with the bosonic particle. You could even try to restore some kind of diffeomorphism invariance. If you remember, in the bosonic particle case, the final expression we like to get was the one which had this diffeomorphism invariance. It had a metric which could be integrated away to recover the standard world line action, the length of the world line. Now, doing things in a diffeomorphism invariant way means that instead of just having the T as a symmetry, you want to have position-dependent translations. But then you would probably also want to have position-dependent super-translations. Another way to say it, right, if we had this symmetry, and then we should ask, how does this transform if I do a redefinition of my coordinates? You probably would like things to transform in a nice way. Now, one thing you could try to do is to just do completely general coordinate redefinitions, which mix tau and lambda in a generic way. But this is not quite the right thing to do, because you sort of would like to preserve this general structure, which has something fermionic which squares to something bosonic. So what turns out to be the right thing to do is to look at this subgroup of all coordinate transformations, which is called the group of super diffeomorphisms. So a super diffeomorphism is a coordinate transformation which has the property that d theta prime is a multiple of d theta, does not mix with d tau. There is sort of a super Jacobian here, which tells you how the theta transforms. And then the usual Jacobian is the square of this. So you can ask, so this imposes some constraints on your coordinate transformations. One could spell them out in full. So the symmetries that, so if you look at the symmetries infinitesimally, they are generated, there is a group of fermionic symmetries, there are some fermionic symmetries and some bosonic symmetries. The fermionic symmetries look like this. Okay, they're just what you would expect. So if you just take the super time translation and you make it position dependent, you get some more general symmetries. And then you look for all the symmetries which appear as anticommutators of this, and the whole thing closes on a group. You can compute the anticommutator between some VF and some VG. And it roughly gives you some FG d tau plus corrections. Okay, so you get a position dependent translation, so a diffeomorphism, plus some corrections. They're a bit lengthy to write down and not terribly useful. It's a nice exercise to find out to make it work. But after all, we are interested in the super strings, not the super particles. So at some point, there is not much point in trying to pursue this all the way through. Once you introduce these general transformations and you see how these Lagrangian transforms, you see that you need to introduce some other things to keep track of, to cancel all the Jacobians. In the old store, in the bosonic case, we added a Wilbein, right? We added some metric. So whose square was the metric. Here you need something like a super Wilbein, which has inside the usual Wilbein. But has some extra guy, if you think in terms of metric, this is a fermionic partner on the metric, which is called gravitino. So if you were in many dimensions, it would be a spin 3/2 field. So when you do this sort of transformation of the Lagrangian, these will have to transform by a super Jacobian to compensate. So you end up writing some action which has now inside x, psi, e, and chi, which is a supersymmetric generalization of what we wrote for the bosonic particle. So alternatively, you can think about this as sort of a gauge-fixed version of this action. And in analogy to the bosonic case, it does indeed happen that if you try to do the path integral over the sort of super diffeomorphisms, you can gauge fix it to become something like that, where L is all that is left from the metric, is the length of the word line, and lambda is sort of some all that is left of the gravitino. In a sense, super diffeomorphisms have one bosonic and one fermionic degree of freedom. You can use the bosonic degree of freedom to almost cancel the metric, and the fermionic degree of freedom to almost cancel the gravitino. You're left with just one zero mode, which are these L and lambda. Okay. Now, going backwards, now we could try to define a string theory based on the same general ideas. So we could try to see what happens if we take our worksheet theory and we make it supersymmetric. So we try to write down an action which is invariant under super diffeomorphisms of the two-dimensional worksheet, involving a metric, a gravitino, and some other fields, modulo super diffeomorphisms. I don't want to write it because everything that involves gravitinos is horrid to write. But the point is that when people, so you have your axis, you have some partners for the axis to make things supersymmetric, you have some metric and some gravitinos, and then you'll try to divide by super diffeomorphisms. And it turns out that while transformations are still there, they have a fermionic super partner, super wild transformations, and then some action. Okay. And then you can ask all sort of questions which you asked before. For example, if you give a surface, first of all, you need to even think, you know, learn how to think about surfaces which are glued together by patches, which involve super diffeomorphisms. So there's a whole theory of super manifolds, which in principle one could think about. Yes?
So the super diffeomorphisms and super wild transformations, they're generated by infinitesimally by vector fields and
which
that depend both on the coordinates
and the super coordinates. Oh. That's right. So in a generally covariant way, there will be two coordinates on the worksheet, U1 and U2, and some thetas, theta 1 and theta 2. And then there will be super derivatives. So that there will be a, let me first do it in flat supersymmetry. I would have some supercharges, Q1 and Q2. And I would have something like Q1. I would have something like Q alpha, Q beta equal to some Pauli matrices or gamma matrices. Something like that. Then you would define some de thetas. Something like this. And look for transformations which only rotate the thetas among themselves. This would be super diffeomorphisms. Do not mix them with the they use. And the super diffeomorphisms would end up having two bosonic degrees of freedom, and I guess two fermionic degrees of freedom. I Now, it's a nice fact that once you count the number of degrees of freedom in the metric and in the gravitino, you discover that you can use these symmetries to make them locally trivial, to make the metric locally flat and the gravitino to vanish. The only non-trivial information is how these flat spaces of pieces of space-time are glued together globally on your surface. In the bosonic case, we had this sort of holomorphic coordinate transformations, these conformal transformations, which left the metric conformally flat. Now there is a more general set of transformations which leave the metric and the gravitino conformally flat, super flat up to super wild transformations. And there's, so this is horrid, okay? Doing things in this is called supergravity, it's horrid. But once you go, once you gauge fix, things become nice again. So now you have holomorphic coordinates, z and z bar, and there are some theta and theta bar. And they're not going to talk to each other. And the super diffeomorphisms are just going to be expressions like that, just involving z and theta. So some f of z d theta plus theta d over dz. Okay, these generate your super coordinate transformations, super conformal transformations, plus some and some bosonic version of that. Of course, right, and for example, your degrees of freedom will now be functions of z, z bar, theta, and theta bar. Okay, when you expand it out, you're going to find some, maybe I should use some fancy, some standard scalar fields. And if you look at the action for these guys, it's going to be just del x, del bar x, plus psi del bar psi, plus psi bar, del psi bar, plus f squared in flat space. This is stupid, goes away, just in something called an auxiliary field. These are free bosons, these are free fermions. Okay, so once you're in conformal, super conformal gauge, everything involves just a free scalar theory and a bunch of free fermionic theories. There are some ghosts, as usual. There are ghosts for gauge fixing. There are ghosts associated to the bosonic different transformations, and there are ghosts associated to the fermionic transformations. So there are some, the usual C and B ghosts, and there are gamma and beta ghosts, okay, which, so this guy has dimension minus one because it's associated to vectors. This is how to have dimension minus one half. This has dimension three half. This is dimension two. The only remnant of that is that as in the bosonic case, we had a stress tensor. In the fermionic case, you also have something called a supercurrent. This is a spin two guy. This is a spin three half guy. There's one vector and one spinor index. Sort of the partner of this, so the same way as cube, there is BRST charge maps the big ghost into the stress tensor, it will map beta into this super super current. So the stress tensor is essentially something which you can use to change the metric locally. This is something that you use to change the cavitino. So the modes of the stress tensor generate diffeomorphisms. The modes of this supercurrents will generate super diffeomorphisms. So in particular, they contain all the information that you need to patch together patches into to make the fermionic analog of Riemann surfaces. And so, as far as definitions go, the superstring theory is going to be a sum over the genus, the string to the usual power, and then some integral over some moduli space of Riemann surfaces, of super Riemann surfaces with some genus and number of punctures. This integral will have a bunch of bosonic coordinates and a bunch of fermionic coordinates. Which are associated to some B's and beta insertions. And then you have some vertex operators that describe the states of the string that are coming in and out. There is a certain amount of complexity in learning how to do this sort of integrals or supermanifolds. Plenty of subtleties. Some of the subtleties were resolved only in the last couple of years because people at some point got bored. It was kind of working and they stopped erasing the little problems. But there is a systematic way to understand it. Now, of course, there is the usual question of when is the BRST symmetry squares to zero, you know, when is that we have superval invariants. The val anomaly is still there. So now you need to still check that the total central charge vanishes. Now the total central charge has a minus 26 from these ghosts, has a plus 11 from the beta and gamma ghosts. And then for each dimension of space-time, you get a free boson, which contributes 1, and a free fermion, which contributes 1/2. So the final result is that the dimension is 10. The number of dimensions is 10. So superstring theory in flat space involves 10 space-time directions. Oh, we still have half an hour. In a good time. Do you have any questions? I mean, at this point, there is not much of understanding something. This is clearly all about building up analogies. Ultimately, all the calculations always involve this board and nothing else. Nobody wants to think about gravitinis ever. Now, seriously, supergravity is an art. It's not a. there are some people that are being chosen to be able to write down supergravity actions. You know, they've been doing it in the 80s. They did it. They've written down. But it's not really systematic. So what I can do now is to write down some useful expressions. Well, the most useful expression that is missing from this board, or from this board, is the expression for the stress tensor. it's silly. Okay. And for the supercurrent, now the most natural step now is to, of course, start learning about the spectrum of the superstring theories. And even before that, we need to understand the theory of free fermions on a cylinder. So we spent some time to understand the theory of free bosons on a cylinder. Now we can do the fermions. So have you ever seen things about the theory of free fermions in the conformal field theory class, in the quantum field theory class? No? OK, good. They are not so different from what we saw for the Gauss, about the Gauss, except their unitary theories are a bit better. Notice, so an action should have weights 1 and 1 under holomorphic and anti-holomorphic transformations. Should, when you transform this action, you should get a Jacobian times the Jacobian bar. The del bar provides the Jacobian bar. So each of the psi has to provide half of a Jacobian. So psi of z should be equal the z prime over the z to the 1/2 psi of z prime under coordinate transformations. The square root creates all sorts of funny business because it means that after the coordinate transformation, if this had simple zeros, something that was periodic might become antiperiodic around those locations. But for now, we don't. This will be important for the state operator map, but for now we can just sit on the cylinder and forget about it. But when we define the theory on the cylinder, we do face two choices. Are we going to take our fermions to be periodic or antiperiodic as they go around the circle? If you take them to be antiperiodic, then you're going to expand into Fourier modes with half integral momentum. Right? You're going to use sine of sigma over 2 so that it goes back to minus itself as you go around. So your psi ends up being expanded in modes which have sort of half integral energy. In the Ramon sector, where the fermions are periodic around the circle, your expansion involves integral modes. Because I'm writing everything for psi, and then I should write things for psi bar as well. The anti-commutation relations in both cases are just this. Okay? They're just completely analogous to one up there. There is no n here. We had an n in the boson case. We don't in the fermion case. This has to do with the fact that the fermions have a first order action. Another manifestation of this fact is that the OPE of fermions is a simple pole, not a double pole. Now, you can use this sort of expression to write down the Virasoro generators. You can compute ground state energies and all of that. An interesting subtlety is that in the NS sector, you can obviously define a state which is annihilated by all positive modes. Okay, and then build up on it. So the next sector will contain 0, psi minus 1/2 acting on 0, and so on and so forth. In the Ramon sector, you have to decide with what to do with the 0 modes. So now you have a bunch of 0 modes. They are gamma matrices. So in the Ramon sector, your ground state must be a spinor, must be something on which your gamma matrices act upon. So in the Ramon sector, you'll have some states which carry true spinor indices in space-time. We call them I and A bar, where psi zero acts by gamma matrices on one index. M psi zero bar acts on gamma by gamma matrices on the other index. And actually, now that you look at this, there was actually no compelling reason for which we decided that both psi and psi bar had to be periodic or antiperiodic. You could have even had situations where psi was periodic and psi bar was antiperiodic. Why not? This would have given you sectors which are denoted as Ramon and Neville-Schwarz. And Neville-Schwarz Ramon. Okay? In principle. When you act on this sort of states, right, now you'll build up things with size of integral dimension. Now, Now, when you look at the state operator map, because of this, something funny happens. So because of, so the state of operator map, the Jacobian state operator map has a zero at the origin. This Jacobian is e to the s and becomes e to the s over 2 when you take the square root of 2. So as a result, things that are antiperiodic in the cylinder become periodic around the origin. And things that are periodic become antiperiodic. So the state operator map roughly tells you that the identity maps to the Neville-Schwartz sector. Now psi maps to psi minus 1/2 over 0. Psi bar maps to psi bar minus 1/2 0, et cetera, et cetera. Sorry. On the other hand, the Ramon states map to something which makes the fermion antiperiodic. They must map to some vertex operator with a property that the vertex operator introduces a cut for the fermion. So having cuts in my correlation function is not good. It means that things are not quite well defined. So when I start trying to define some string theory amplitudes, map them to the sphere, say, I kind of want these four operators to be local with each other. I don't want this operator to go to minus itself as I go around. Because if it goes to minus itself as I go around and I integrate over the space of four configurations, I get zero.
Isn't
yes?
Isn't there this trick where you could relate a fermion in bosonic system, chiral bosonic system, to a bosonization which deals with exactly this kind of?
Mm-hmm. You could bosonize these fermions, but it's not a terribly good idea because it breaks Lorentz symmetry.
Right.
It makes Lorentz symmetry not manifest anymore. So she's referring to bosonization. There is a beautiful fact in two-dimensional conformal field theory that if you take two fermions, you can pair them up and make them into a boson. It's a kind of funny boson because it's valued on a segment, but of very specific size. But it's useful for some calculations, but the problem is that if you're pairing up fermions, you're breaking Lorentz symmetry. Now, so when you define a conformal field theory, or when you define it, you need to sort of write down a sort of maximal list of operators which are local with each other. For example, if you decided I want to be able to use the fermions, all the fermion modes, I want to be able to use these states in building the string spectrum. Well, this state is not local when you, is an operator which is not local when I bring it around this. So if I wanted to use these, I would have to just renounce using the Ramond operators. That would be potentially okay. But it would essentially give you back some bosonic string. Completely boring bosonic string. See, these states are all bosonic fields in space-time, these sort of states. Another thing you could do is to say, OK, fine, maybe I will just limit myself to things that contain true fermions, like psi bar minus 1/2, psi minus 1/2, 0, okay? or okay. Well, that will be okay. So I can renounce talking about these guys. This will allow me to bring in these guys in the story. So in general, one way to think about it is that there are two operators which are valued in 0 or 1. That's a defined modulo 2. They tell you what is the number of psi's and the number of psi bars, roughly, that you have in a state. And if you want to include all sectors, both Ramond and S, both NSNS and SR, RNS and RR, then you'll have to make sure that all the states have. So if I want to have all my sectors, then I need to make sure that all my states are local with those. With these sort of twist fields are called. So that all the states have an even number roughly of psi's and an even number of psi bars. This will call you what's called, this will give you what's called a type 2 string. It's nice because it has states which carry one spin or index. So it has fermions in space-times. Another thing you can do, as I was saying, you could just say I keep only an SNS and RR. And allow myself to have either, so that means I need an even number of fermions in total, but I could have epsilon, epsilon bar, and I would be okay. This gives you something that is called type zero strings, which are pretty useless because they have a tachyon. But these will turn out to have no tachyon. Understand why it takes just a little bit of effort, more effort. Naively, Let me just first. Put together the various ingredients. So we have the fermions, we have the bosons, we have the ghosts, bosonic and fermionic ghosts. So, what could a state of my Hilbert state look like? Well, for example, I could say I take a momentum mode for the bosons. We have time until 15, right? I take the vacuum for the fermions, and then I take some ground state for the ghosts. And because my fermions are related by my ghosts are related by supersymmetry to the supercurrent, which is made out of the fermion and the boson, I better use the same periodicity conditions for the superghosts as I did for the fermions. Okay, questions?
It seems like the zero strings would also be type of two strings, right? They're also because in the two strings, I also allow the RR in the...
So this string theory and these string theories will have some states in common.
Okay.
For example, they will both have a graviton. But these will have extra fermionic states.
Mm-hmm.
These will have extra bosonic states. Unfortunately, the first extra bosonic state is a tachyon. So now, the conditions for these states to be on shell are very similar to the ones we had before. On shell states will have to be killed by positive modes of L. They'll have to be killed by positive modes of G. And they have to have L0 equal to 1/2. Well, okay, what I really mean is that they have to be killed by L0, by the total L0. But the ghosts have L0 equal to minus 1/2, the ground state of the ghosts. It used to be minus 1 for the BC system, but now there are also the beta gammas that are contributing. And at the end, you know, when the dust settles, you end up with a minus 1/2. So naively, this will be on shell when p squared is equal to 1. And this would look like a tragedy, it's a tachyon. But what saves the day is that when you look at the fermion number of this ground state, it's actually minus 1, minus 1. It's a result of a tedious calculation, but it's a fact. So that means that this state, this tachyon, is there in type 0, but is not there in type 2. The next interesting states are built up with this psi and psi bar. They contribute 1/2 to the energy. And so they have p squared equal to 0. They have two indices. They have total f equal to 1. They have minus 1 to the f, sorry, equal to 1. Because now I added a fermion. So these remain. You get a graviton, the B field, and dilaton. So in the NS sector, we have the familiar massless fields of the string, and we have no tachyon. So this is good. Next, of course, we need to look at all the other sectors. We need to look at the NSR sector, the RNS sector, and the RR sector. And it will give us other excitations, which will be particular. These ones will give us fermionic things. And these will give us some extra bosonic stuff in the space-time. Now, in order to understand what do we have, we need to kind of spend some time with gamma matrices and spinors in 10 dimensions, which are perhaps not completely familiar. So we need to ask questions about spinors in 10D. Even better, even more precisely, spinors with 9.1 sigma in R 9.1. So spinors for SO 9.1. Now, you have probably seen spinors only in four dimensions, I would assume. And the properties of spinors in various dimensions depend kind of sensitively on the dimension, although there is sort of a periodicity by 8. So the properties of spinors in D dimensions are very similar to the properties of spinors in D plus 8 dimensions. Now, in particular, when I say properties, I mean things like, is it a real representation of the rotation of the Lorentz group, or is it a complex representation of the Lorentz group? Is it does it split into left into two chiralities or not? Now, there is a systematic way to build a spinor representation out of the gamma matrices, which is the following. So you take your, suppose that we are in even dimension. So and you have a bunch of gamma matrices which satisfy this anti-commutational relation. Then what you can do is sort of build these combinations. These combinations have a nice property. This one square to zero, an anti-commute. This one square to zero, an anti-commute. But this and this anti-commute to one, or two, whatever, as a matter of normalization. This and this anti-commute to two, and so on and so forth. So you can sort of try to use these as creation and annihilation operators. You can say, so let me call these things B, you know, B zero, B one, B two, all the way, and this may be B bar one, B bar zero, B bar one, and so on. So you could say, let me take one state. Which is annihilated by all the Bs. Then I can build a whole representation for these algebraic gamma matrices by starting with this state and adding in the B bars. When I acted with the maximal number of B bars, I get to some other state on which I could go back by acting with the Bs. Now, in this construction, I broke Lorentz symmetry, so at least making it not manifest. But it's a good way to count how many states you have in a representation of the Gamma matrices. You have, in this particular representation, you have 2 to the d minus 2. Now, when you act with Lorentz group, the Lorentz group generators are anticommutators of Gamma matrices. Right? That means that the Lorentz group will never map this into this, because all Lorentz group transformations involve an even number of b's or b-bars. So you can sort of split this into the guys involving 2 b's or the guys involving 1 b or odd number of b's. This splits your representation into 2 chiralities. You can even define an operator, the chirality operator, which is just the product of all the gammas, which acts as 1 here or minus 1 here. Now, on top of this, you can ask other questions like, is this representation real? What happens when you do a complex conjugation on this representation? And so on and so forth. And as I was saying, the answers depend sensitively on the number of dimensions.
Do you have both 2 to the d over 2 minus 1?
Yes. I divided by 2.
Oh.
Yeah, it's not completely obvious, that's true. But if you look at some simple examples, right, of binomial, so the the sum of even guys and the sum of odd guys are equal. So it turns out, so sometimes, for example, complex conjugation would map, or reflection in space-time would map one chirality into the other. Like in 4D, if you do a reflection of space-time, you map left movers to right movers. Now, this is always true, because a reflection is implemented by one gamma. But also, there are questions about complex conjugation. Now, in 9,1 dimensions, you have real spinors, which are, there are real chiral spinors and real anti-chiral spinors. So you can find a representation where all your Lorentz matrices are real. This is not obvious. For example, here we definitely used eyes all over the place. It's not obvious at all. It follows from the fact that you can write 8-dimensional spinors in R8 are real, which in turn follows from some very nice properties of SO8. It's not obvious, but it's a fact. So we have 16-dimensional real chiral spinors, Majorana called chiral spinors. So they are called Majorana wild because they're real, so they're Majorana, and wild because they're chiral. So you have Majorana wild spinors of both chiralities. So when, now notice that to go from one chirality to the other, you add to the gamma matrix. So the 2 chiralities have opposite Fermion number. So maybe I should actually give them a little. So here, when we start analyzing the Ramon spectrum, we'll have to split each of the spinor indices into chiral and anti-chiral. They'll have different F. And then we'll have to figure out which ones contribute to the I erase it. So which ones have f equal to, which have total Fermi number zero? So which do we keep? And there is a choice to be made. Okay. So there are presentation of the gamma matrices which come from psi's and the one that comes from psi bars. So we have some a dot, a bar dot. So chiral and anti-chiral for the left movers, and chiral and anti-chiral for the right movers. And there is a ambiguity in deciding which one has this, if these two have the same Fermion number or opposite Fermion number. Okay. So there is one choice for which their Fermion number 1, 1, minus 1, minus 1. And there is another choice for their Fermion number 1, minus 1, minus 1, and 1. Mm-hmm. Pretty arbitrary.
Does this choice affect anything?
It affects a lot. It gives two different string theories. So there are type 2b and type 2a. So in the next lecture, we're going to write down the spectrum of type 2a and type 2b. Maybe even say a couple words about B-brains and dualities.